85 News.
From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. It's Tech Tuesday. Later in the broadcast, how quirky web lingo might be ruining your child's schoolwork. But first, keeping high-tech pirates at bay. The Bush administration is ramping up its talk about punishing the people who rip off America's intellectual property. The White House released a list last week of the countries that failed to respect the copyrights and patents behind digital goods and pharmaceuticals. The U.S. is ready to go beyond putting together a list of the usual suspects and might push for sanctions against some of its trading partners. Who will be winners and losers of this new enforcement regime at home and abroad? Joining us by telephone to discuss this is Stan McCoy. He is Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for Intellectual Property and Innovation. Stan McCoy, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Kojo. It's nice to be on with you.
Good to have you. Your office says pirates are running free in countries like China and Russia, not the swashbuckling, seafaring pirates, but counterfeiting, network hacking pirates of the digital era. How do you trace them to these countries?
Well, we run a public process where we invite industry and other members of the public to share information with us. So that's a big way that we get our input from the private sector and other stakeholders. And we also talk a lot with the other agencies of the U.S. government, the law enforcement agencies and the people in the know about these problems, and get their insights as well.
The U.S. Trade Representative designates 46 countries in this year's special in the categories of priority watch lists and a lower level watch list. What's the difference between the priority watch list and the lower level watch list?
Well, it's basically about the intensity of our engagement with the U.S. government. Those countries that appear on the priority watch list are the ones we'll be working hardest with as the U.S. government to try and achieve some progress on intellectual property issues that are of concern. The watch list, we'll be working with those countries as well, but it's not as high a priority.
What kinds of problems does this pose for the American economy? U.S. Trade Representative Susan Schwab says that counterfeit drugs pose an enormous safety problem, for instance.
Well, you know, all told, about a third of the value of U.S. corporations, $5 trillion or more, is bound up in knowledge assets of some kind. So that can be a famous brand, it can be a copyrighted song or a piece of software, it can be an invention like a patented drug. The protection of those knowledge assets is really critical to the U.S. economy. And as you pointed out, Kojo, it's also critical to the health and safety of U.S. consumers when it comes to products like pharmaceuticals or auto parts, the failure of which could obviously lead to very serious consequences if that reached a U.S. consumer.
Can you talk more specifically about China and Russia? What are the specific threats they posed, and what is the Bush administration doing about them?
Yeah, China, to start with, is obviously a huge workshop to the world, a huge exporter of all kinds of different goods, and it's also the leading source of counterfeit and pirated goods that are seized at the U.S. border. So we're working intensely on a number of different tracks with the Chinese government to try and improve the situation and reduce the problem of exports of counterfeit and pirated goods from China and clean up the Chinese market itself. So we're using a variety of tools that range from WTO dispute settlement and the World Trade Organization, which is a form of litigation where we ask China to live up to some of its trade commitments to strengthen enforcement against intellectual property. And we're also using bilateral dialogues with China to try and get them to step up and do more on issues of critical concern, issues like the manufacturing of ingredients that go into making counterfeit benefit pharmaceuticals and better controlling that manufacturing. On the Russian side, Russia is working to get admission into the World Trade Organization, which is the leading international body that sets and enforces trade rules between countries. And we're working with Russia in that accession process to define some steps that the Russian government will take to enhance its protection of intellectual property across the board.
We're talking with Stan McCoy. He's an assistant U.S. trade representative for intellectual property and innovation. In this Tech Tuesday conversation about defending intellectual property rights, you can join that conversation by calling 800-433-8850. What do you think we should be doing to protect our intellectual property abroad? 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Joining us now by telephone is Susan Sell, Director of the Institute for Global and International Studies at George Washington University. Susan Sell, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Hello, Kojo. Hello, Stan.
Hello.
The USTR is very focused, that's the U.S. Trade Representative, is very focused on beefing up enforcement. Susan, what approach do you think the administration should be taking?
Well, I have a little bit different view than the one expressed by Stan. And one country you didn't mention that's mentioned as a priority watch list country is Thailand. And Thailand is on the priority watch list in part because it used compulsory licenses to get generic drugs available to its population. And that's one of the reasons that the USTR cited Thailand on the watch list. But in fact, their practice is completely lawful under the World Trade Organization rules. So sometimes the United States pushes for intellectual property provisions that go beyond what states are required to do, and Thailand does not belong on the watch list for doing something perfectly legal under the World Trade Organization agreement when it comes to the compulsory licensing of drugs.
Well, Susan, I suspect that a lot of countries would say that, look, in order to get not only drugs but other kinds of things to the poorer people in our population, we have to either ignore or overlook intellectual property rights as they are observed in the U.S. Where do you draw the line?
Well, I mean, the way that I think about it is the approach that the USTR is taking now is very ahistorical. We have a lot of invention to protect in the United States, and it makes sense that we have strong property rights. I think those rights have gotten too strong at the expense of the public interest, and that things like fair use for educators, the space for using copyrighted materials for non-commercial purposes, for example, has shrunk. But more profoundly, I think, thinking about it from a north-south perspective, that people in the global south are transferring large rents up to the north to pay for intellectual property. It's not really in their interest to do that. And the United States, for example, historically everyone develops by piggybacking on other people's inventions. We didn't have strong intellectual property laws for copyright in the United States. We used to take Charles Dickens' books and run them off mimeo machines and sell them for 2 cents because we wanted an educated reading public. Charles Dickens, of course, was very unhappy. But it doesn't really make sense to have very strong intellectual property protection when you're just starting to develop, you're starting to learn how to innovate, you want to be able to reverse engineer things. That's how the Japanese figured out how to make tractors that worked in rice paddies. You know, they reverse engineered international harvester tractors. So it doesn't really make sense globally. And also in the United States, there's a lot of questions about how strong our intellectual property rights are. Many people are saying they're too strong, they're choking off innovation in the information technology sector with the BlackBerry case that you probably remember.
Yes, I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, they're saying there's too many patents. We can't make these multifunctional handheld devices without fearing that we're going to infringe on somebody, so we have to roll this back.
Let me bring it back to the international again, Stan McCoy, because one of the points Susan Sell makes is about the north-south divide, meaning between poorer and richer countries. Is that something that your office has to take into account as it looks at the issue of intellectual property rights internationally?
Yeah, Kojo, it's definitely something that we take into consideration. We understand that not every country is at the same level of development, and our expectations of a very advanced developing country would naturally be different than our expectations of, for example, a least developed country.
The report, as we mentioned earlier, Stan, puts 36 other trading partners on a lower-level watch list. What do those countries, which include a number of developing countries, do to deserve that label, and what can they do to get off the watch list?
Well, it really varies, Kojo, from one country to another. So in some countries, it might be the failure to enact any kind of a patent law. In another country, and this is true for many countries, it's a challenge of getting a handle on the problem of counterfeiting and piracy and having good and credible enforcement for laws that are out there on the books. So we are willing to work with any country on this list, and we do work with almost all of them at one level or another to try and define particular kinds of steps and improvements that they can make in order to be removed from these lists. And there's really a very happy story in the report this year about improvements that different U.S. trading partners have made in order to get off the list.
What's that happy story? Is it all of MP3.com?
Well, all of MP3.com is a website that the Russian courts have been working to shut down. But what I had in mind on this year's list, Kojo, is the steps that have been taken by particular U.S. trading partners, especially Egypt, Lebanon, Turkey, and Ukraine, all of which are being moved in this year's report from the priority watch list down to the watch list. So that's
what did they do?
They each improved in different ways on some of the issues that they were confronting in the area of IP enforcement. So in Ukraine, this was a country where a few years ago we had a very bad problem, particularly in the area of piracy of optical discs, things like CDs and DVDs. And the Ukrainians, over the course of several years, have completely reformed their IPR regime. They've joined the World Trade Organization, and we've recognized that progress this year by moving them down to the special 301 watch list.
Susan Sell, I want to get back to Thailand in a minute, but first let's talk about piracy and digital copyright infringement. You, it is my understanding, feel that access to technologies in developing countries will really suffer as a result of the administration's policies? Susan, are you there?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Yes, I do believe that. They don't have access because of our, what we do is we use a lot of trade leverage. We pressure these countries to adopt inappropriate policies, policies that are inappropriate for them, that mean that things are going to cost more, they won't have access to them, by using leverage, saying we're going to threaten you with trade sanctions if you don't abide by this, or we won't invest in your country if you don't enforce these rules that really don't make a lot of sense for
them. And it is your view that the administration should have a development agenda to go along with its enforcement strategy. What would that development agenda look like in your view?
Well, it would most of all, it would give countries more autonomy, more policy space to design intellectual property policies that are a larger piece of innovation, a national innovation program, because intellectual property is a means. It's not an end in itself, and it's a means for innovation and for dissemination. And I think what's happened here and the way we project ourselves globally is that IP, intellectual property protection, has become an end in itself, losing sight of what it's really there for. It's to promote innovation and for dissemination. And I think, thinking of the digital realm, open source models have been very popular. There are a lot of innovation in that field without strong, using things like Creative Commons licenses.
Sure.
Many countries, many governments have adopted Linux systems instead of Microsoft for their government offices. And there's a lot of opportunities, but at the same time, with open source, for example, there's also efforts to lock this up with digital rights management and encryption and all different kinds of ways to ration access, whereas I think a development agenda should be about promoting access.
Indeed, Stan McCoy, if you are negotiating with a country like, Saudi Arabia or Jamaica, and the government of that country says, look, we have a lot of poor people, we would like them to have access to technology. If your intellectual property rights laws are imposed very severely here, we will be significantly limiting access for those people to technologies that ultimately they will need. Is that negotiable?
Well, Kojo, we don't negotiate sort of commercial deals for particular intellectual property right holders. What we try to do is ensure that our trading partners around the world are providing a good, solid framework of rules and enforcement mechanisms so that the intellectual property system is going to be respectful of the inventions, not only of Americans who want to sell into that market, but also of domestic innovators and entrepreneurs. So in many developing countries, you're seeing really thriving industries develop around the issue of intellectual property. So in countries like India and Nigeria, for example, you've seen the development of vibrant film industries that depend on having some form of intellectual property protection. So I would have to disagree with Susan in the sense that intellectual property is not just for the rich or for the North. Intellectual property is also part of the means by which developing countries can aspire to higher levels of development and step up. And you, in fact, as we interact with developing country governments around the world, we see many of them very interested in talking to us about ways that they can use intellectual property as a tool to enhance their prospects for development.
So, Susan Salif, India and Nigeria says, look, we feel that we can ignore intellectual property rights if we want to get generic medicine to our people, but if you want to use any of the technology that was developed over here, we will be looking for international enforcement of our intellectual property rights, whether from the World Trade Organization or some other source. What do you say to that?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
What Stan seemed to be suggesting is that on the one hand, the intellectual property rights laws, while they do protect people in the United States, they do also protect people in third world countries, which are increasingly developing new technologies of their own.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. But the problem is the intellectual property policies that the U.S. has pushed globally is a one-size-fits-all policy that resembles U.S. standards of protection. And what I'm saying is, yes, there's sectors. The Chinese are patenting agricultural biotechnology like there's no tomorrow. I mean, they're the biggest, the biggest filer of patents now in agricultural biotechnology, or the most quickly rising power doing that. But there are other sectors that they don't want to have really strong intellectual property protection. And that's the kind of policy space that they don't have anymore. And it's also in order to, you know, pick a la carte. Well, we have a strong film industry, so we want a certain kind of protection for that. But we don't yet really have a good, you know, machinery industry, and we don't want protection for that. We want to be able to reverse engineer. I mean, they've lost that ability to pick a la carte what makes sense for them, what their comparative advantages are in innovation versus imitation and learning by doing. A lot of innovation starts with, as every kid knows, by taking the alarm clock apart to see how it works. More and more of these kinds of activities are in violation of somebody's intellectual property rights. And there's also a troubling angle in my perspective about the foreign economic policy that we're projecting for innovation and for high standards of intellectual property protection, when domestically in the United States, there have been Supreme Court decisions recently, Circuit Court of Appeals decisions, the Federal Trade Commission, National Academy of Sciences, they've all come out with these critical decisions or rulings saying maybe we've gone too far. All the discussions about patent and trademark office reform, maybe our system has gotten so far in the direction of property rights that we're choking off and stifling innovation.
I'm afraid we're running out of time. Stan,
that's just that skepticism.
No, I'm glad you raised that concern because it gives me the opportunity to have Stan McCoy give a response to that, to the issue that Susan Sell just raised. Stan McCoy?
Yeah, Kojo, I think across the board, we feel like having our trading partners provide a friendly and stable environment for protection of intellectual property rights is just critical to U.S. exports. It's critical to U.S. jobs, and it's critical to high-paying U.S. jobs in technology-intensive sectors. And that's what we're all ultimately all about here. It's also good for our trading partners in the sense of giving them opportunities for further development and growth. There is flexibility in the system, and we respect that flexibility, but we also recognize recognize the critical role that intellectual property plays in prospects for economic growth, growth in American exports, and growth in the part of our valued trading partners in the developing and in the developed world. So this continues to be a big priority.
And this debate obviously will continue as well. Stan McCoy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Stan McCoy is Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for Intellectual Property and Innovation. Susan Sell, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Susan Sell is Director of the Institute for Global and International Studies at George Washington University. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, how text messaging and instant messaging and emailing has been affecting your teenagers' writing. It's Tech Tuesday. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5. I'm Matt McCleskey. At 2 o'clock today, join us for Tell Me More with Michelle Martin.
Next time on Tell Me More, as Tell Me More celebrates its one-year anniversary, we ask the Mocha Moms to celebrate their new beginnings. We talk about becoming a new mom, finding the right childcare, and striking a balance between taking care of baby and taking care of you. I'm Michelle Martin, the Mocha Moms, and one of our own Tell Me More new moms, next time on Tell Me More.
That's coming up at 2 here on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Books A Million, presenting President Jimmy Carter, signing copies of his new book, Remarkable Mother, today at 7 p.m. at the McLean, Virginia Books A Million. Line numbers are being distributed today. From DentaQuest. DentaQuest provides a variety of customizable dental plans. Information is available at DentaQuestDental.com. From the University of Maryland, Baltimore County's Department of Information Systems, offering an online master's program in information systems. Applications for summer semester are due May 11th. Information is at www.onlinems.umbc.edu.
Partly sunny skies are in the forecast for the afternoon, highs in the lower 60s, and we could have wind gusts of up to 25 miles an hour. Currently 54 degrees in northwest Washington at 1228, as we return now to the Kojo Namdi Show.
Many parents and teachers today worry that their children are losing the ability to write in proper English. The explosion in written electronic communication among teens has led to what can seem like a whole new language. Those not in the know can often be baffled by shorthand notations like LOL, BRB, or TTYL that pepper teens' written communication with one another. But a new report from the Pew Internet and American Life Project finds that while teens do occasionally let that informal style slip into their schoolwork, there is also hope for the English language and even a lot of good that can come from teens' frequent use of written communication. Joining us to talk about the report and the future of writing, Amanda Lenhart is a senior research specialist with the Pew Internet and American Life Project and the lead author of the report. It's called Writing, Technology, and Teens. Amanda, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Joining us by telephone from Berkeley, California, is Richard Sterling, a senior fellow at the College Board's National Commission on Writing and a professor in the School of Education at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you for joining us, Richard Sterling.
Thank you.
Amanda, a lot of attention has been paid to the results of this study, and we will, of course, talk about those. But first, can you tell us how it was that you decided to study this topic of how teens write, both inside and outside of school?
The Pew Internet Project is very interested in how teenagers use technology in general. And we found in our previous research that communications technologies are incredibly important in the lives of teens. Much of this communication occurs over text, text messaging, instant messaging. And we were beginning to wonder, we'd started to hear about these things showing up in school-based writing, and we wanted to know, how did these things really affect the writing that teens were doing? And obviously, the National Commission on Writing is concerned about the state of writing today. And so the two of us seemed like logical partners to try to understand the intersection between technology and writing for teenagers.
How was the survey structured? I remember my own life as a teenager, adults always wanting to know, what it is they're doing now? And probing into it. So how was this survey structured?
Well, we started the project by doing a series of focus groups because we really wanted to understand what teenagers thought writing was. We didn't want to impose our own ideas about writing on the study. So we heard actually in that teenagers had quite a different idea of what writing was than we did. So when we actually developed our telephone survey, which we administered to 700 teens and then one of their parents. We actually tried to structure it very deliberately to make sure that we allowed teens to tell us what they thought writing was.
Your survey found that most teens do seem to know the difference between formal and informal writing. In fact, many of them don't even consider their informal communications outside of school to be even writing. Just how much are teens writing on their own outside of school?
Well, teens actually are doing quite a bit of writing outside of school. Certainly, they're doing more of it inside school. We found that certainly teens are writing on a daily basis. In fact, half of teens are writing on a daily basis in school. Outside of school, it happens less often. But certainly, nearly 9 in 10 teens told us that they do write outside of school at some point. And every teen that we talked to in our survey actually does write for school.
And it's my understanding that some 60% of those teens said they don't consider that to be real writing.
It, particularly, they were talking about the kinds of electronic communication that they do, the text messaging, the instant messaging, the emails. They don't consider that to be writing.
If you'd like to join the conversation on Tech Tuesday and teenage emails and text messaging or instant messaging and what kind of writing you think it is, do you think your teen writes more than you did at their age? Do you think the writing they're doing is helpful? You can call us at 800-433-8850, or you can send us an email to kojo@wamu.org. Richard Sterling, do you see the fact that teens make a distinction between their informal written communication outside of school and what they think of as real writing in school as positive or negative?
Yes, I see a lot of understanding on the part of teenagers of the kinds of writing that they do outside of school and the kind they do in school. That doesn't mean, of course, that some of it doesn't creep in and creep across, but that's what teachers have always done. They've always had to correct students who use inappropriate language. But what we're excited about is just the sheer amount of writing, not just instant messaging and text, but also blogs. In fact, I would say that young people are writing more than ever before.
Most media outlets have focused on the findings that teens' informal style of writing outside of school has occasionally crept into their schoolwork. But you don't necessarily think, Richard Sterling, that this is the crisis that some are making it out to be. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I'm very excited. I read a lot of blogs from different parts of the country. Not all the writing is brilliant, of course, but they are engaged in ideas. And one of the things that we are looking at is to see how we can capture that passion and excitement that young people have in writing into the school classroom. Often when they move across to writing in school, the energy goes out of it. And I think we as teachers have to find ways to capture that excitement and get them as engaged in schoolwork as they are outside.
Again, you can call us 800-433-8850. Are you worried about your teen's language skills being degraded by their instant messages? 800-433-8850 is the number to call. Amanda Lenhardt, one of the aspects of this study that we found fascinating was the revelation that many teens spend a lot of their time writing by hand, and that many prefer it for a lot of their writing.
Yeah, that was something that actually surprised us as well. Nearly half of teens say that they do much of their schoolwork by hand, and about 90% say they do the bulk of their personal writing by hand. Now, I think it's important to understand the context of that. A lot of school writing happens in the classroom.
Sure.
And still very few teenagers have a one-to-one in-class access. There aren't as many schools with lots of laptops kicking around, so of course teens are taking notes with their hands, with pencil and paper. So I think that does make sense. But even when they are confronted with the option of both a computer and handwriting, oftentimes they will actually choose to compose by hand or even to start the writing process by hand.
And then later they'll go and type it up. But for their out-of-school writing, a lot of teens apparently like writing by hand, for example, in a journal, or they like writing letters to people. We thought that was like so 1980s.
I think still it is. There's certainly computers are quite ubiquitous in the lives of teens, but when it comes to writing short notes to people, handwriting a letter to your grandmother, those are still the kinds of things that you do by hand.
Again, the number is 800-433-8850. Amanda Lenhardt is a senior research specialist with the Pew Internet and American Life Project and the lead author of the report we're discussing on this edition of Tech Tuesday. The report is called Writing Technology and Teens. Joining us by telephone is Richard Sterling, senior fellow at the College Board's National Commission on Writing and a professor in the School of Education at the University of California, Berkeley. Do you think good writing skills are important for future success? Call us, 800-433-8850. Richard, as someone deeply involved in education, when you look at this report, what stands out as important to you in terms of how educators can help teens learn to write better?
I think the biggest challenge of this report is that so many teens enjoy what they do outside of school much more than they enjoy what they do in school. And one of the things about, one of the reasons I think teens think that writing is what is not what they're doing outside of school is that writing is often associated in their minds with the less interesting topics that educators assign. I think we need to negotiate with young people about the kinds of passions and excitement they have so that they can do that writing as part of what they do in school. And I think that would make a big difference. I think that's the biggest challenge.
Among the surprising findings of this survey, Amanda, again, is you found that both parents and teens generally believe that writing was an essential skill for their future. It also found that teens report wanting more help with their writing skills. Did teens say anything about the ways they felt schools could help them become better writers?
Certainly. We had two questions about that. And in each case, nearly 8 in 10 teens believed that there could be improvement in their in-class classroom instruction. And in particular, they wanted more class time devoted to writing. And also the addition of technology applications that might help engage them more thoroughly in the writing instruction in the classroom.
Richard, given that you were talking earlier about how do we make writing more interesting in the classroom for students, did this study, this survey, have any suggestions to you about what teachers might be doing to get young people more interested in in-school writing?
Well, this report actually verifies and validates some of the work we've done in the Writing Commission. Teachers, effectively, reading and math have dominated the scene, and the writing is often referred to as the neglected R. We do need much more time for writing in the classroom, but in the current climate, it's rather narrow. Testing has dominated a lot of the education systems, and writing is seen in part as a luxury, and that, I think, has to change. Writing is essential. In fact, most of the reports that we've issued have showed that if you don't know how to write well, you'll be stuck at the bottom of the career ladder for your entire life.
But teens seem to get that, Amanda Lenhart. At least they get that that's what they're saying in the survey. But as Richard is pointing out, that may not necessarily translate well into how they're doing it in the classroom.
Well, you're right. Certainly we see that, you know, parents and teens, 8 in 10 of each of those groups think that writing is essential for their future success. And they do see this desire to have more engagement in the classroom. But that may not be necessarily how the time in the classroom goes. And I think certainly, I think as Richard points out, there's need for more teacher enrichment and more teacher support for teachers who wish to or want to incorporate more time and more technology tools in the classroom for teaching writing.
We'd be interested. Go ahead, please, Richard.
Sorry, yes, I think also that we have to have a hard look at the way in which testing and assessment is being done. It's actually having the effect of narrowing the curriculum, and we need to really have a hard look and see how writing can be put back into not just English classes, but writing to learn information across the subjects, across history and social studies and sciences. Writing is at the key to really fine learning.
If you are a parent of a teenager, you can call us at 800-433-8850. How much time does your teen spend sending, for instance, text messages? And how do you feel that is affecting his or her writing? Or if you're a teen, you can also tell us and call us and tell us how you feel that text messaging and instant messaging is affecting your in-school writing. 800-433-8850 is the number to call. You can send us an email to kojo@wamu.org. Here's this email we got from Margaret, who says, I was 10 years old in 1995 when my family got access to the internet at home. Before the advent of children and internet usage, my mother was concerned about us kids learning to type. She tried to make us practice and learn typing on a computer program. Little did she know that I would teach myself to type because of the time spent in middle and high school on the internet. I am now 23 and working in the real world and can type faster and more accurately than many of my older peers. I'm not sure the internet and digital media made me a better writer. I would credit reading books for that, but it did make me a better typist. Care to comment on that, Amanda?
Certainly. certainly, I think teens do acknowledge that the time that they spend engaging with this media has a lot of positive benefits. In fact, they told us that teens and parents usually both agree that it helps you to revise and edit more easily. It helps you to present, can help you to present your ideas more clearly. It can also potentially help you to communicate more effectively, and then, of course, obviously, to type more effectively.
And, of course, if you're doing a lot of text messaging, you might have the fastest thumbs in the North, East, West, or South. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue our Tech Tuesday conversation on teens, the Internet, and writing. And looking to hear from you, call us, 800-433-8850. Tell us about your experiences with this, or send us an email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up at 1, new insights from dead economists, plus Life on Steroids, a look at a documentary exploring whether American culture encourages people to use the juice. Today at 1 on the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. At 2 o'clock today, it's Tell Me More with Michelle Martin.
As Tell Me More celebrates its one-year anniversary, we ask the Mocha Moms to celebrate their new beginnings. We talk about becoming a new mom, finding the right childcare, and striking a balance between taking care of baby and taking care of you. I'm Michelle Martin, the Mocha Moms, and one of our own Tell Me More new moms, next time on Tell Me More.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 o'clock here on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Blattner Brunner, delivering global, national, and local communication solutions to help clients in D.C. and across the nation solve complex marketing challenges. More about Blattner Brunner is online at blattnerbrunner.com. From the German Embassy and the German Information Center, now celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Berlin Airlift. In 1948, the airlift created a legacy of friendship. More information is at germany.info.
A mix of clouds and sun this afternoon. High temperatures could reach the lower 60s, and it could be breezy. Wind gusts up to 25 miles an hour are possible. Currently 55 degrees in Northwest Washington at 12:43 as we return to the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
It's a Tech Tuesday conversation on whether all of those LOLs, BRBs, and TTYLs in your teenagers' instant messages and text messages are affecting how they write in school. We are inviting your calls at 800-433-8850. Have you ever seen any informal writing creep into your teenager's writing assignments? And we're talking with Richard Sterling, senior fellow at the College Board's National Commission on Writing. He's also a professor in the School of Education at the University of California, Berkeley. And Amanda Lenhart, who's a senior research specialist at the Pew Internet and American Life Project and lead author of the report Writing, Technology, and Teens. Here's Ralph in Columbia, Maryland. Ralph, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, thank you. I would like to make a little comment regarding the statement that I heard from one of your guests saying that those with inferior writing skills will forever be relegated to the lower rungs of business life, or some such statement like that. I've been for nearly 20 years a documentation manager at a scientific instruments company here, and for a long time I felt exactly as this gentleman did. However, I have seen some PhDs come into our company, and their writing skills were, I have to say, horrendous. I was pretty sure they would never go anywhere, but as it turned out, their ability, their technological abilities, as well as their business acumen really brought them pretty good success, and they've become very well respected. So I just thought I'd like to put my two cents in on that one.
Well, allow me to have Richard Sterling respond, but first this question. Has their writing improved since the time they first came in?
Actually, not much. They when they have to write something, they usually send it off to someone to fix. Very often that's me, but not always. So they know what they want to say. They just don't express themselves very well.
Richard Sterling, care to respond?
Yes, I actually am largely in agreement, but my statement had much more to do with surveys that we did of Fortune 500 companies who said that if you don't come in with actually minimum decent writing skills, you're not going to go very far. One of the problems with PhDs, and I've seen this in my own discipline, is that there is a tendency for disciplines to invent their own language. And a lot of the ways in which universities have put the PhD programs together has made it all very, very difficult for that jargon and that kind of convoluted prose to be straightened out. I'm completely in agreement with that. I think it's a terrible fault at that higher end. My reference was really to the younger people who are perhaps not learning even basic writing skills.
But you know what this also means, Ralph, is that you'll never be out of a job. Thank you very much for your call, Ralph. We move on to Mary in Arlington, Virginia. Mary, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment disagreeing with the premise that text messaging and IMing would possibly make teens better writers. For I have a couple teenagers. We do not allow IMing and text messaging. We're kind of a low screen time family. And the nature of teen talk and teen phone conversations and teen texts would be such a short interchange and such a conversational style that I don't know that it could enhance their writing skills. Where I was totally turned on to the idea that blogging would, and that might, if anything, make me allow my kids to open up a blog just to allow them to develop their ideas in a little longer format and respond to some other ideas.
Any distinction made in the study, Amanda Lenhart, between the instant and text messaging and blogging?
Yes, actually. We did not include blogging in our assessment of electronic communication. That's a legacy sort of construct from our previous work that we did, and we didn't want to change it because we wanted to be comparable over time. Blogging is quite different, in fact, and we find that teens who blog are more likely to say that they write on their own for their own personal enjoyment than other teens, and they're also more likely to believe that writing is extremely important for their future. So blogging is related to a greater tendency towards personal writing. Writing and writing importance.
Is there any way, Richard Sterling, that blogging can be included in classroom education in such a way as to make it more, as to make writing in class or in school more interesting for teens?
Yes, I think that's already happening. I know of several high schools where blogs are internal to the school and are posted on a variety of subjects, and I think that is one way to engage students. I'd like to make one comment, though, about instant messaging and texting. The thing is that writing comes in a variety of forms. I think that teens are very well aware of audience and context, and they know very well that when they're communicating to friends, it's one kind of thing. If it creeps across to another genre, then I think it's a teacher's job, or indeed a parent's job, to point out when language is inappropriate. It would be no more appropriate to ask you to make sure that your spelling was correct and your grammar was correct in writing a shopping list than it would be to not expect that in a full paper. Teens will talk to each other in their own language, as they do now. It's just a question of getting fluency, and I think that even text messaging can improve fluency because you're still composing a thought.
And I want to pick up on something that Richard said in terms of audience. Teens told us in the focus groups that we did that actually having an audience for your writing is incredibly motivating to them. It's one of the things that they found extremely motivating, including having a relevant topic, writing creatively. And I think blogs are a wonderful way to do that. It's a wonderful way to go out there and get a broader audience than you might have in any other aspect of your life, particularly as a teenager.
Thank you very much for your call, Mary. You too can call us. The number is 800-433-8850. We're talking teens, the internet, and writing. Have you seen any informal writing creep into your teenagers' writing assignments? Do your teens take their school writing seriously? 800-433-8850. Here's an email we got from Esther in Washington. I would be interested to know whether you have observed any decline in teen knowledge of correct grammar as a result of their informal writing. As a teacher at Johns Hopkins University, I have noticed a sharp decline in the grammar skills of many of my students, and I'm curious to know how much of that, if any, results from text messaging and other forms of informal writing. Find out anything about that in the study, Amanda?
We didn't ask specifically about decline in skills. I mean, certainly we did find that 2/3 of teens do have some of these informal styles in their schoolwork, in particular lowercase capitalization. About 50% told us that they did that. And the sort of text message shortcuts, about 38% said that they did that. But in terms of whether that's related to the grammar instruction in the early years versus the kinds of text messaging that they're doing, we didn't ask about that.
You know, Richard James Billington, the Librarian of Congress, has suggested that young people's electronic communication was damaging, quoting here, the basic unit of human thought, the sentence. But you're not so sure that these new ways of writing are necessarily so destructive. Can you tell us about the ways in which you think the English language itself could change in the future?
Yes, I will tell a story that has already I've already told a couple of times about what happened almost 17 or 18 years ago with my stepson. He wasn't using capital letters after periods, and so I asked him why he wouldn't do that. And he said, well, if you can explain to me what a capital letter does that a period hasn't already accomplished, I'll start using them. And I couldn't. So the English language is a very flexible language. It's one of the reasons that I think it's so adaptive to world cultures. And I think that it changes over time. Commas are far less in use than they were 30, 40 years ago. And we're seeing changes too. I don't know whether I personally will ever stop using capitals. I think I'm too used to them. But I do see those changes. And I think that I worry a little bit about the shortness of some of the communication. I think that media has encouraged this. I think that the quick news flashes have always reduced thinking to rather doing some harm to the meanings of things. But basically, I think that teens will find new ways to say things, and they will also find new ways to say longer things. Blogs are very complex, some of them. So I think that that's the future of thinking.
Here's an email we got from Rita who says, everything in life, business or personal, local or global, is negotiable. If citizens of any age lack the ability to skillfully write or speak to support attempts to negotiate differences in views or opinions, the situation quickly dissolves into argument and worse. Communication skills are vital to our education process and our places in the world, and I would suspect, Amanda Lenhardt, that that's one of the reasons this survey was conducted in the first place.
Absolutely. I mean, certainly we think that, you know, teens are obviously doing a tremendous amount of communicating. 85% of teens do some kind of instant messaging, text messaging, and most of them do this on a daily basis. And so, of course, we wanted to understand what was going on between that and other kinds of writing.
You mentioned blogs a great deal. In looking at teens writing outside of school, what trends did you find as far as how different forms of writing affected their level of output in school? There's text messaging, there are instant messages, there are blogs, there are emails that they write to one another.
Certainly.
Did any one form or another affect their writing in school more?
Oh, that's a great question. And certainly we looked at these communicators, how teens communicate, whether they use instant messaging, text messaging, like I said. And we also looked at this group of heavy communicators, teens who actually use these media on a daily basis. And we actually found that whether you're a heavy communicator or not doesn't seem to have an impact on how much you write for school, how much you write outside of school, how frequently you write. In fact, the only thing that was different was blogging, which obviously, as I mentioned before, does increase the amount of writing you do outside of school. But just using a lot of instant messaging or sending a lot of text messages doesn't necessarily translate into any more or less writing for school or outside of school.
Let's go to
May I add to that?
Please go ahead, Richard.
One of the things that we are also noticing is the number of young people who are creating content on the internet. And that doesn't mean just blogs, but it also means music and video. And, of course, much of that is written out first, but that kind of creativity is increasing enormously. And I think that's taking into account the other kinds of communication with which young people are so familiar.
Indeed, apparently one of these things that this survey found, Amanda, looking at these things demographically, is that, one, girls are much more likely to write on their own outside of school than boys. The other, that black teenagers seem to write a lot more outside of school in writing lyrics and music and in journals.
That's right. We did see some of those differences that you suggest. We're not entirely sure why we saw some of those differences. With girls, I think it has to do something with a cultural sort of focus on being verbal for girls. However, the other differences, we're not entirely sure why those occur.
Well, I can tell you from anecdotally, every male black teenager I know has a lyric in his pocket someplace that he's willing to whip out and read to you at any given time. Yeah. Here is Bill in Falls Church, Virginia. Bill, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. I'm a retired school teacher, and I found that vocabulary was so important. That is the lack of vocabulary kids had. You could speak to them or write something for them, and they wouldn't tell you that they didn't understand critical words. My other point is that there is a hand-to-brain connection in writing that I think we've developed over 10 or 20,000 years, and that gets short-circuited, I think, sometimes with the keyboard.
You mean by handwriting to brain?
Yeah, when you actually write with a pen or pencil.
Do you see that distinction, Richard Sterling?
Well, this gentleman may have hit on one of the reasons why teens still like to write by hand. I think there is something very pleasurable about putting pen to paper or putting pencil to paper. But I also see a lot of young people who, for whom the keyboard is such a natural thing. They've been using it since they were 6 or 7 years old. And there does seem to be a new movement in that direction. But I'm getting on in years too, I agree with the gentleman. I think there is something that is unique about using a pen on paper.
Amanda?
I think certainly we discussed, there is a, teens do gravitate in many cases towards the pen and pencil. But I also would say that, you know, Richard's point is also a great one, that it's still a movement of the fingers and the hands on the keyboard. And for many teens, that is where their facility lies. Their handwriting is terrible, and they would much rather type than actually write by hand when they have to turn something in because it can't be read.
We're running out of time very quickly, but when you look at this report, there are a lot of very interesting facts and figures, but like any set of new information, it probably also raises some new questions. What questions do you have now that you would like to explore in a future survey?
Certainly, I'd like to know more directly, what exactly is, can we quantify writing? Can we understand the relationship more directly between the actual use of a computer versus handwriting and how that directly relates to the quality of what teens write? Now, that's certainly not something we spoke to in this report, but that's something I'd like to know.
Well, we'll be looking for it in a future report. I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Amanda Lenhart, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Amanda Lenhart is a senior research specialist at the Pew Internet and American Life Project. She's the lead author of the report we were discussing. It's called Writing, Technology, and Teens. Richard Sterling, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Richard Sterling joined us by phone from Berkeley, California, where he is a professor in the School of Education at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also a senior fellow at the College Board's National Commission on Writing. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on The Kojo Nandi Show, checking your politics at the office door, a look at rules governing email, bumper stickers, and chatter in the federal workplace. Plus, it's your turn to set the agenda, why Americans love taking pot shots at cultural stereotypes, and why two presidential candidates are pushing for a gas tax holiday. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. Hour 2 of today's Kojo Nandi Show.